Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Hi, and welcome back to The Carol Markowitz Show on iHeartRadio. This clip came across my feed the other day on Twitter, actually, and I have to say something about it.
Okay, so boyfriend and I have been together 8 years, and that's because we met really young. I was 20 when we met. Haven't got married simply because, like, neither of us have wanted to yet. And I guess now I know a lot of people wouldn't date someone for 8 years without a ring, and that's totally fine. Like, that's your prerogative. But it works for us. Next thing is that I pay my boyfriend rent. In the past, when we've rented properties together, we've split the rent. Now my boyfriend has purchased a house. I'm still an adult that needs a place to live and pays for the place she lives. I just happen to pay that money to my boyfriend. People are upset that I'm doing this work for free and I'm not gaining equity in this house. Way that I look at it, and he was able to buy this house because that has been a goal of his. I didn't have the ability to take on that risk. I don't see it as my place to, like, reap those gains. To me, it would be weird to not help. Just like a friend helping out. People are gonna have a problem with the fact that I just referred to myself as a friend, but I am my boyfriend's friend. If my boyfriend dumped me tomorrow, like, yes, the gains in the house would be his, but I can live with that. The other, like, little nuance is that, like, my rent is pretty low. It's definitely low for the size of house we live in and the location that we are. So, like, if it makes you feel better, you could kind of look at it as, like, my rent is subsidized by the work that I do. I'm doing this work because it's fun and it improves the home that I live in. I will now stop talking about our relationship and get back to removing paint from old things. Please give us a follow if you want to see how my vision for this house comes to life, whether it's for me or my boyfriend's future wife.
Now, this girl is 28 years old. And she's contributing toward the mortgage of her boyfriend, who she has been dating for 8 years. She says that they were too young to get married, but they're living together and now they're in their late 20s. I know I push marriage on here, and this is a great example of why. What is this woman doing? I'd be so upset if this was my daughter dating a guy for nearly a decade, not on the path to marriage, and helping him pay for the home he owns, but she does not. You know, she says things like people are going to get upset or this upsets people. I'm not upset for her. I'd be upset if it was my kid. She could do whatever she wants. She's a stranger on the internet. I think this is particularly crazy to do, but I, you know, don't really care what strangers do. So for me, I'd be upset if it were my kid doing this. Even without marriage, I'd point out that this guy is not interested in taking care of her. I know women can do it for themselves. They don't need no man. She mentions she's an adult, whatever. But that's ridiculous. We need each other. We take care of each other. It's not a one-way thing. She's taking care of him. He's not taking care of her. To me, this video is a public service announcement for our daughters to not fool themselves into believing that living like this is somehow a win. Somehow this is feminism. She apparently made this video responding to a comment that said she's getting the home ready for him and his future wife to live in. But that's how I see this ending too. You're dating for 8 years. Where is this going? Why wouldn't you be married yet? This makes no sense to me. I mean, just the fact that she's financially helping him, like, build up his equity in a home that is not hers is wild to me. You're not into marriage, fine. But I'll be telling my kids to not do this pretend marriage thing where one person gets all the benefits either. Coming up next, an interview with Inez Stepman.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cash back on purchases. And pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Welcome back to the Carol Markowitz Show on iHeartRadio. My guest today is Inez Stepman, Senior Policy Analyst for Independent Women's Forum and host of the show High Noon. Hi, Inez.
Hey, Carol. It's great to talk to you.
It's so nice to have you on and to see you. We used to hang out a lot in New York and, you know, one of us had to move away.
Well, I moved in, so I was the newcomer in New York, and then everyone I knew left, including you.
Right, because you did the rare pandemic move to New York. Mm-hmm. What made you do that?
My party trick is telling people, you know, imagine one of those horror shows where everybody's locked up trying to get out of the city after an apocalypse, mm-hmm. and there's one car going in. That was me and my husband. We came to New York December of 2020. So
what made you really do it? It just seemed really fun to be locked in a smaller apartment.
Well, actually, because of the pandemic crisis, we're probably the first people in history who went from DC to New York and got a bigger apartment, but then we got, you know, booted out of that apartment based on the price increase. In any case, no, we had been planning to move to New York actually in roughly in May of 2020. And then as those plans were taking place, the pandemic hit. And so we delayed it for a while, but given the low prices and stuff, it seemed to make sense. My husband had just gone remote. So my husband, Jared Stepman, he works for the Daily Signal, but he had gone remote before the pandemic. And so we were sort of free to move to New York. And that was our plan. So it wasn't, we just kind of delayed our plan by a little bit, but it was our plan to move here. I like this. In all honesty, my husband was, you know, doing me a favor by moving here.
Husbands do that. Yeah.
Yeah. I just love New York. I've always loved New York. I've wanted to move here for a decade and a half. But it never like sort of practically made sense. And so
have you enjoyed it?
Yeah, I have. I mean, obviously it's facing a lot of problems as virtually every city, is. I'm a city person. I need to be able as particularly to walk. Our architecture is really important to me. A certain attention to aesthetics is really important to me that you don't find, I think, in a lot of American cities outside of New York. So just for that daily beauty, which I realize a lot of people look at New York and they're like, oh, look at the garbage. What are you talking about? The daily beauty. But I really think there is an enormous daily beauty in New York. There's a rhythm to it. There are beautiful buildings that you can look at walking around. It's enjoyable. It's energizing to walk around in New York. Mm-hmm. So despite all of the problems, and then of course, there's just the enormous amount of things you have access to here, culturally, artistically. It just, to me, day-to-day life here is exciting and is beautiful. And so I've always had a romantic feeling about New York, which my actual New Yorker friends always tell me is cheesy and lame.
No, not at all. I think New York is a beautiful city. I was the biggest New York evangelist, New York supremacist, and I used to like take pictures of the city and of the bridges as I went over them or things like that. And I would, you know, tweet, I'm sure your city is nice too, but like, this is my city and look at it. So I totally get that. I don't like not liking New York. Like I'm still deeply a New York lover overall. It's like the child that you have to like let go of and let them do their own thing because you've like gotten tired of fighting for them. Maybe that's a bad analogy because I actually would not stop fighting for my children, but for my children, I had to leave New York. So that was kind of the sad truth of it. But I love how you love New York. And that reminds me very much of the way I felt about it. And I love to see it through your eyes. I love to watch you, you know, become a New Yorker and really live there. And it's been great. I've been loved to watch you.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are certain policy consequences that you can't escape with children. Part of the reason I think it's easy for us to stay here is because we don't have kids. I understand perfectly why you left.
Right. I mean, I've written like
schools and crime,
20,000 words on it. So
yeah, it's schools and crime. Although I will say this, crime in New York is much worse than crime in New York in 2019. It's mm-hmm. palpable. It's visible. You see,
really?
You know, you see it a lot more. You even just walking around, there are definitely more like high people wandering around. There's definitely, I can see my citizen app ticking up day by day. That being said, the focus from our own team, Carol, the right, on New York as sort of the disaster zone of the country, I think is really not accurate in terms of the big cities in America, all of which are basically, except for Miami, maybe Dallas, are making the same policy mistakes. Yeah. And they started not nearly as safe as New York. Mm-hmm. So people seem from outside the city sometimes to think like, oh, it's dangerous to walk down the street in Manhattan. It isn't. It's it's fine. I mean, it's more unpleasant than it used to be. You definitely have to be a little more alert than it used to be. But comparatively to DC, I mean, when I lived in DC in 2018, before any of this happened, there were 12 murders within half a mile in one summer of where I lived. And I lived in a nice part of DC.
Yeah.
So like, comparatively to that, there hasn't even been one murder in my close vicinity since I moved here. So,
So it's a win, you know? The depressing part to me is that New York solved like the mystery of can a big city be governable? Can it be livable? And then threw it all away and then just decided that didn't actually happen or that didn't work the way we wanted it to or whatever. And that's like the depressing part to me. It's not the, you know, cities will have challenges. I always say this, but I grew up in a much worse New York than exists now. And yet I couldn't live in this New York because this New York didn't take seriously the threats that 1980s New York took seriously. So crime was far worse in the 80s when I was growing up, but it wasn't a debate. It wasn't like, what are you talking about? What crime? What crime? There's no crime, you know? And that's what I felt was going on, especially in the neighborhood that I lived in Park Slope. It was like, literally, if you said, you know, oh, the crime's going up and I'm a little nervous about that, or can my kids walk around alone the way that they could, you know, 6 months ago, you were racist and how dare you bring this up? And that's the part that I like could not live with. And, you know, also talking about like beauty of New York, like one of the things I miss and it's funny, but like the way people really try, they like dress up. And I mean, it's people in Florida look good. Do not get me wrong. Like way better than like, let's say Park Slope, Brooklyn, like where I felt like nobody tried it at all. But you know, so there are things about New York that I think are beautiful and amazing and that I, you know, miss about them. I just hate that they threw away decades of good government and good policies to, you know, the ideology of the moment, which turned out to be, you know, fool's gold.
Yeah. I mean, it is a tragedy. And coming from California originally and from the San Francisco Bay Area, I mean, I had a front seat to the tragedy that is San Francisco. Mm-hmm. In my view, much worse than New York, even though and they start out with a baseline of like San Francisco is has a very, very small Black population, for example, which does correlate with the crime rate. San Francisco is incredibly wealthy. It's much smaller than New York. Like all the demographics of San Francisco would point to the fact that it should be as it was, which was like an incredibly safe city. When I was growing up, I mean, I used to go when I was 14, 15 years old, I used to walk around in the Tenderloin District by myself as a mm-hmm. teenager. There was no question that that was fine. I mean, yeah, there were some people doing drugs at San Francisco. Mm-hmm. There were some homeless people in San Francisco. But there was a real tipping point, and it was entirely, as you say, it's like entirely the choice of people who live there to throw away all of the natural beauty of San Francisco,
yeah,
natural safety of San Francisco, everything that's wonderful about San Francisco, to just like put it in the trash can. Mm-hmm. And in San Francisco, it actually, the tipping point, I don't want to imagine how bad it's gotten, although I've seen plenty of the reporting and stuff, but the tipping point really was 2015, 2016, where the actual experience of the city, and again, I'm a city person. I'm not somebody who is shocked by seeing a homeless person on the corner or,
right. You know, I've seen it all.
By people fighting or whatever. But in 2016, it became San Francisco, the actual enjoyment of being in the city, the walking around, the sitting in the cafe, all of that started to very aggressively be impacted by the fact that the city basically threw open the doors to every drug addict in America and said, hey, shoot up here.
Crazy. Why would you do that? You know,
look, they have their idiot rationales. But it very, very clearly fell off a cliff at that point. So I share your sense of tragedy. I do think there's a couple institutions in New York that are keeping it from going completely nuts, at least for now. Because obviously the city council is insane and they like to go down the same path as DC, as Seattle, San Francisco, right?
And it's funny because there are more Republicans now on the New York City Council than like in decades. It's just the leftists on the city council, the Democrats have become far left is really what happened. So you have actually more quantity of Republicans. I think there's five now, which was unheard of in, you know, the last number of years. But the Democrats have just become
insane.
Know, crazy people.
I mean, and it's, they do have two institutions, like I said, that I think help balance a little bit. One is that the NYPD is the best force in the world. I really believe that. I mean, it's remarkable what they're able to do when they're allowed to do it. And they're very large force, like per capita, comparatively to a lot of these other cities. So there are the cops to put on corners, and they're very well organized. And then they have clout, apparently, behind the scenes, right? I mean, the police union is still a big deal in New York politically in the way that it's completely non-existent. And I can demonstrate very easily how that works between DC and New York. I cannot imagine, and Carol, you've spent plenty of time in DC. Can you imagine the kind of parade that was put on for the fallen officers maybe 2 years ago, where you have just like hundreds, maybe thousands of cops marching you know, down the street in New York? For that would never happen in San Francisco.
That's
it would never happen in DC because there's such a hostility to the cops. There still is like a pride in the police force here among average people. And I think that's really important. And it gives them the clout, I assume, a little bit behind the scenes, although I'm sure that their lives are much worse than they used to be. Don't get me wrong. Again, I'm not downplaying.
No, I fully get
it. Just comparatively to these other cities.
That's really interesting. I've really never thought of that. But yeah, they're absolutely.
Well, you should think about the second one, which is that they have the New York Post.
Yeah, well.
Which there's no major daily newspaper with a actual city readership. There are conservative journals and so on.
Yeah. No, everybody like reads the Post. Yeah. Like everybody across the political spectrum in New York has always read the Post.
And the Post reports on crime, and the Post hosts conservative opinion. And the fact that that's a daily newspaper in New York, that's in everybody's bodega, like that people, ordinary people, apolitical people, not like you and me, read, I think is an enormous asset for the city and keeping it going completely insane. Now, maybe all those things will be overcome and the left will steamroller all of those things.
Let's root for New York. I mean, like, you know, I hope they don't. I hope that the voices of sanity win and you get to live in a beautiful, safe New York the way that I remember it, that it should be right now, but, you know, isn't for a lot of reasons. So what do you mostly work on at IWF? I mean, I obviously read a lot of your stuff, but what would my listeners want to know about what you do?
So I have a kind of funny hodgepodge of issues. I did do more than a decade as an education policy analyst. So I still do some education stuff, school choice, K-12 policy stuff. I also have been working a lot on higher ed recently. So I have a proposal out to tax the university sector for loan forgiveness. And I think this is going to be, I think this has the potential to be a huge win for the right. There is an enormous pressure to forgive student loans. And I think we often talk about it as a matter of individual responsibility, which it is. I'm not saying that the 18-year-old signing on the dotted line, didn't legally incur that debt. But the entire system since the 1960s really has been structured to push as many people, prepared or not, into college as possible. And I think it's a little too much to assume that the average 18-year-old is more financially savvy than the U.S. Congress that put these loans, government loans, in front of basically every high school graduate in America. The universities get their money up front. So they're, they're rolling in.
Right,
they created enormous wealth from this policy that is directly directly financed by the U.S. taxpayer. And, you know, everyone else is kind of screwed, right? The taxpayer is screwed because, by the way, we hold all these loans. So if a large proportion, as is predicted, default on the student loans, and it could be anywhere from 50 to 60%, that those are like reasonable estimates of how much, like what default rate we're likely to see. We already own all those loans. The Department of Education owns 93% of those loans. You know, those companies like Moella, whatever it's called, or Navient before it, they're just managers of, they're hired guns to manage the loans and collect payments. But the U.S. government owns that debt. So we're already on the hook for it. I think we will have a default bailout, whether we like it or not, by default. So to my mind, the fair way to do this is to take some of that enormous wealth that's been amassed on the basis of the backs of the U.S. taxpayer by institutions that are overtly hostile, and I don't think anyone can argue that point in 2024, hostile to everything that's good about this country and about America, to take the money from those institutions and use it to essentially settle up with those who were preyed upon, frankly, by this system, by this promise that if you take on this debt and go to a four-year school, oftentimes a four-year school you're totally academically unprepared for because the graduation rate's only 60%. But these schools were admitting people because everybody comes with a government check that they get up front. Yep. So a lot of those defaults are people who are admitted to schools that had no chance of ever graduating from for the money for 2 or 3 years, and they are stuck with the debt and they have no degree. And anyway, like I could talk forever about this, but I think that there is a lot of merit to taxing universities for this. For the right, I see it as a twofer. We hit our institutional enemies because that's what they are. And we justly make the people who have made money off of the system pay for the fallout of it instead of the U.S. taxpayer and the majority of Americans without a four-year degree, you know, redistributing their wealth towards paying off loans for people who did go to college, who did go to, for example, law school, which seems blatantly regressive.
Yeah. So who is opposed to this politically? Like, obviously the colleges are against it, but who, like, I can see the argument from both the Republican and the Democrat side of why this is a great idea.
Democrats don't see it that way because I think they know better than Republicans who their friends are. The real political question is, why have Republicans been willing to fund universities at such an extreme rate and give them such a special little deal from the federal government for so many years when universities have always been overtly hostile to everything Republicans believe in? That's the question. It's a matter of political will on the right. If Republicans prioritize this, I think that we could very well drive a wedge between Democratic politicians who know that the universities are an incredibly valuable indoctrination resource to them, and Democratic voters, because, you know, look, the kids with these loans, they don't care if it comes from Harvard.
Right.
They're happy to have them bailed out. Right. So, I was on Dr. Phil, weirdly enough. He did a series at the end. He did a series of like policy chats on various political issues. And I think I convinced a fair number, because everyone came on there saying, I need my student loans bailed out. And I think I got a fair number of them convinced, you know, yeah, it's right that the university should pay for this and not, you know, people who didn't go to college. That's not fair. So I think it would be a very politically smart argument for the Republicans to make. I think it would put a lot of pressure on Democrats. And I think more than anything, it would politically cut off the knees from a strategy that Biden used in the midterms. I'm pretty sure he will use going forward in this 24 election, which is to promise a bailout he knows is going to get knocked down by the court to get young people out to vote. It worked for them in the midterms. And Republicans can destroy that political talking point. They can provide a real solution for people who are legitimately struggling with what in any other context we would call predatory loans.
Yeah.
And they can hit their institutional enemies and make it a wedge issue on the left. I don't see a downside to the right pushing this. J.D. Vance has introduced something real similar to my proposal. It wouldn't be very difficult for Republicans to tax at university endowments, for example. There already is a very, very, very tiny tax in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. All that would be required would be to expand that tax and treat them like the hedge funds that they are.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back on The Carol Markowitz Show.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
See new things. Try new things. Go back centuries while living in the moment. Forge new paths while discovering old ones. Pedal, paddle, and paint while trekking, tasting, and tailoring experiences that transform you into a better version of yourself. Immerse yourself in the world by activating your mind, your heart, and your body on a river cruise exclusively from Avalon Waterways. Save with limited time offers at AvalonWaterways.com. Avalon is cruising. Elevated.
So what would you be doing as a career if you weren't doing this, if you weren't doing policy, if you weren't writing? What would be then as plan B?
Do I get booted off as a trad wife if I say I'd rather just like arrange flowers at home and paint my apartment different colors?
Wait, who's booting you? This is like this is a safe space.
I don't know, like in terms of professional work, I think I'd make a pretty good architect. Actually, I was good at math. I was pretty good at sketching, and I really enjoy looking at buildings. I don't have any extensive knowledge in architecture other than what I like, but
that's okay. This is fantasy land.
It would
you know?
Fit the series of my skills, like the sort of design and aesthetic element with the mathematical and analytical kind of, that's more what I'm good at. I'm not like I'm not an artiste, but I think the combination of aesthetic and mathematics would appeal to me. There was no, I looked for courses in it, but there weren't any at my university.
I think I'd be a DJ. I think that would be my,
I can see it.
You know, I feel like I know how to get the party going.
Yeah.
I also enjoy planning travel. Yeah. So maybe a travel agent. I like those two, like, you know, fields. But I, you know, trad wife was the original plan for me. I don't know how I got off that track. And my husband sometimes says, you know, he signed up for a stay-at-home mom, stay-at-home wife, and I decided to go have a career, which is like a crazy thing to do. So, you know, so anything's possible, really, is what I'm saying here. Do you feel like you've made it?
You sent me this question in advance, and I still don't know how to answer it. I don't think I've made it. I would say that there are things that I'm more grateful about in my career as the years go on, especially in this environment, the fact that I have the freedom, enormous freedom, even within our profession. I'm so grateful to IWF for providing this. I mean, they don't have a one voice policy. They really do hire, you know, a variety of smart women with a variety of views from, you know, moderate, independent, all the way to conservative. Like, I'm clearly mm-hmm. conservative. But they really do an enormous job of supporting women who want to make an argument about X, Y, and Z. That kind of freedom is, when I think about, oh, like, would I rather be an architect or something like that? You know, there are ways in which I'd rather do that. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, there is no escape from politics now.
Right.
And when I think about what the corporate office politics is like now, mm-hmm. when I think about the things that are allegedly offensive or like a problem for HR, I'm incredibly grateful that I don't have that kind of job.
Because I don't think I'd be able to tolerate it for HR.
Yeah. I've never talked to HR. I've never mm-hmm. used HR. I'm enormously grateful for that. And I feel like it's a rare thing now to be able to work in our current environment, which maybe you agree or don't. I think it is pretty close to not like Stalinism, you mm-hmm. know, not like being thrown in the gulag, but by the time you get to the Soviet Union in like the 70s, right, where
obviously
very
killed.
Different structure.
Yeah.
Very different structure. And there's a long discussion we had about like the similarities and differences. But mm-hmm. in terms of the feeling of, well, you know, you just don't share your opinions unless
right.
you really know the people, mm-hmm. You know, like who you're talking to. There's just all these like trip wires. You can't really, you can't really just do your business and have your friends and live your life. Like the political system is intruding into that private sphere in a very direct way.
Yeah.
I think in that context, all the more grateful to have the position I do, because I don't think I deal very well with, you know, being told that something
yeah.
that I'm saying is offensive and therefore
right.
like I'm going to lose my job, and mm-hmm. having to balance those two things. I have the utmost sympathy for people who feel they have to do that. Like I'm not naive about it at all. I don't think everybody needs to be Solzhenitsyn, right?
Right.
Like I'm not, and I don't mean just in talent. I mean that I'm not directly threatened that way. And I don't know what I would do if saying
right, right.
what I say meant that I couldn't make rent.
Absolutely.
You know?
I found an essay that I wrote in college where I was already an open conservative, but I wrote about how the traditional family was outdated. And of course, you see, I got an A on it. And I remember, I mean, I don't remember this, I don't remember particularly writing this essay actually, but I remember having to kind of adjust my opinions to what I knew the professor wanted to hear. Because what was the point, really? I was there to get the good grades. I mean, who cared what my professor thought about what, you know, what I thought? Like, why would I need to debate him or argue out my point? You want to hear that the modern families, you know, the traditional families outdated, like, here you go. Hey.
Yeah. My dad, like you, as you know, but for your mm-hmm. audience, my family comes from communist Poland. So, sort of similar, Warsaw Pact style, background. And my dad, even in my high school in Palo Alto in the like mid 2000s, mm-hmm. I mean, he had that feeling about, oh, like you're getting assignments that you know what you're supposed to write.
Yeah.
And he was like, this is like being in the this is like being in communist Poland. Like right. the proletariat are always oppressed. They always rise up. Like, you know what you're supposed to write. And yes. It's the same stuff. And that was like, I think the early wave of that, but it was already there in the 2000s and in public school, right? It was mm-hmm. already the vision that America's sins are so much greater than yes. her triumphs, that of course, her sins right. are unique mm-hmm. and her triumphs are irrelevant.
Right.
And yeah. And it is like, again, I don't want to over.
No, I get it. I mean, I never plug my book on my show, but like in Stolen Youth, the book that we published, my co-author Bethany Mandel and I in March, it opens with a history chapter which compares a lot of what's going on right now to what has happened in totalitarian societies in the past. And we're not saying that anybody gets thrown in a gulag right now or, you know, like that, but there's definitely some threads that. Of connection that are obvious. And I think that if people, you know, don't see them, then maybe they're saying what they're supposed to be saying. And maybe that's why.
Yeah. A friend of mine told me a story. He's a professor and I won't use the names or whatever, but told me a story about a graduate student of his from Belarus. And for people who have not followed it, there were huge uprisings in Belarus in 2020 and after basically a very obviously faked election. And it is known, Lukashenko there is known as the last dictator in Europe, mm-hmm. obviously like stealing everybody, all the money, like blind stealing from his people. And in any case, there were a lot of protests there and unrest. And this Belarusian student was talking to her professor and she said, you know, when I first came to America, I had the idea that it was like a free country, you know, and mm-hmm. I was amazed by this fact. And I thought how incredible, like everyone can say whatever they think about politics without this kind of fear. And then she literally physically leaned forward, looked behind her and said, I've learned you just have different tripwires. Like there are different things you're not supposed to say here. Mm-hmm. And the physical act of like leaning forward and checking behind you before you say what you're going to say, mm-hmm. like this itself is so emblematic to me of how we've lost the freedom that America is known for or was known for around the world.
Yeah, I fully agree with you. And look, I do it myself. I could think of times in the past where I like looked around before I said something in a restaurant and, you know, I had to be careful about who could hear what or not to have an altercation or something. So it's sad. And I hope we are climbing out of it because I do feel like wokeness and this whole, you know, insane culture is coming to an end because it just can't last. You know, eventually you run out of victims because it's a circular firing squad and everybody's getting hit. What would you say is our largest cultural or societal problem? And do you think that it's solvable?
I think the largest problem is probably loneliness. I think it's a small L liberal problem. Some people would call it atomization. I think we're discovering that the unchosen relationships, the things that are not entered into as a matter of contract and benefit and detriment, are very, very difficult to maintain in a civilization as prosperous as ours. And you see it a lot in the sex wars, right? Where if you look at in almost every country, you have single women politically pulling way, way, way away from single men. All the mm-hmm. single women are left-leaning. The men are actually, they're leaning right and turning a little more right, but like it's not a comparable turn. But mm-hmm. if you look at the numbers in the long term, look at the numbers in the United States of women voting Republican, married women vote Republican, married men vote Republican, single men vote Republican, single women vote, you know, by a margin of 30 or more points, vote Democrat. Mm-hmm. I think those politics are a reflection of not. And even the extremes of the sex war on the right and the left now, where you see like the manosphere, and which I think originally had a lot of good points, and I was considered myself sort of adjacent to it. Mm-hmm. Now it really does seem sort of, in at least some portion of it, I don't want to broaden out. It really does seem like hate women for being women, which I find right. is ludicrous, is hating men for being men. Mm-hmm. But I think those sexual politics burn real hot because we don't have in real life ties. I mean, the average American is now born into a family that's either never, you know, their parents either never married or their parents are divorced before they're 18, right? We have fewer siblings. on average, smaller family size, all of those things, I think. And then you enter the dating market and there's just an endless number of hours of podcasting tape, quote unquote, on the just general screwed upness of the dating scene, right? Mm-hmm. So it's very easy in our society now to go. Oh, and the final point, friendship is totally collapsed, right? If you look even since the 90s, the percentage of people who say they have, let's say, more than five friends completely collapsed and in the toilet. So it's very possible that you can now, it's very common to grow up in a broken home mm-hmm. without any, you know, close relationships with siblings of the opposite sex, without a good relationship with your parent of the opposite sex, and then without any real good friends of the opposite sex. And then your only interaction with the opposite sex is like messages on dating apps.
Right.
And I can see why that would make somebody form a very negative opinion of the opposite sex.
That's a great point. Yeah.
I think it's not just about sexual relationships, but about mm-hmm. friendship, about family relationships. We just have fewer of those thick ties. And the problem with liberalism and prosperity writ large, which I'm a fan of both to some degree, right? Is that the short-term preference of people, you know, having those kinds of thick community ties. And I think mm-hmm. your own like very public, beautiful writings about your relationship with Judaism and the Jewish community demonstrate this very well. Those thick ties are not easy or pleasant a lot mm-hmm. of the time, right? Like there's a lot of conflict in small towns and between church sure. ladies and
right.
Those things are not necessarily pleasant. Family relationships are not always pleasant. They're difficult. And so the short-term interest of a lot of people is to basically say, well, I'm going to do me, right? I'm going to do me and I'm not going to be constricted by those relationships, those deeper unchosen relationships, because any serious relationship constricts what you can do. Obviously like marriage constricts sure. what you can do sexually, right? Mm-hmm. But any deep relationship is exclusionary by nature. It means that two people are going to have to make room for each other in what they want to do and what they want to say and what they want to, you know, there's a negotiation there. That negotiation is not always pleasant, especially short term. And I think what we're seeing is the short term incentive is to dump those relationships. And in the long term, that's killing us.
So do you think that's solvable?
I don't know. I don't know if we'll be able to come up with something to replace the fear of destitution, mm. right? Because you didn't keep with your family because it was always pleasant. You kept with your family because you might be out on the street and starving.
Right.
And that's all, you know, same reason that divorce was much lower. It's social convention, but that social convention also comes from, you know, the very real fear of mm-hmm. losing your children, of being cast out. I don't know, like, I don't want to return to to destitution.
No, that's
not a solution. So mm-hmm. I don't know if we'll be able to come up with something that, I mean, maybe we are smart enough as a species to start considering these long-term interests, but maybe not. Mm-hmm. But I will say that the direction we're currently going, forget about politics, on this question, the direction we're currently going is all downhill. The therapeutic language of how to speak to people like is actually deeply horrifying to me. It in a pre-political way, it bothers me. It places distance all the time, distance between people to talk to them in this like, well, you're intruding on my boundaries. Yeah, that's what friendship is. You know, if you have everybody outside of your boundaries, you have no friends.
Right. That's absolutely right. I'm reading Abigail Schreier's Bad Therapy right now.
I can't wait to read that.
Oh, it's amazing. It's so good. I can't put it down. It's really a great book. It's coming out soon. And Bad Therapy by Abigail Schreier. Highly, highly recommend it. So I love talking to you. This has been awesome. End here with your best tip for my listeners on how they can improve their lives.
Throw dinner parties. Talk to people in real life. I think that parties might save us.
I feel like that's probably true. All right, throw parties. Thank you so much, Inez. Thank you for coming on. Love talking to you.
Thanks so much, Carol. It's been great.
Thanks so much for joining us on The Carol Markowitz Show. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Are the old world picturesque shores of Europe calling you? Set sail on an adventure with Avalon Waterways. Enjoy an elevated cruising experience. Avalon Waterways offers smaller ships, bigger experiences with fewer people and more of, well, everything good about river cruising. Don't just dream about quaint towns and cobblestone villages. See them for yourself and make lasting memories. Discover limited time offers today at AvalonWaterways.com.